Hello, I'm Lori Hennessy, and I'm the CEO of League of Education Voters. Welcome to Washington Game Changers, a one-on-one conversation with powerful leaders in a time when we need to hear about good people who do good in this world. One of the good people who's done a lot of good in the world for a long time is my guest today, Estela Ortega, who has given almost 50 years of her life to El Centro de la Raza, a nonprofit whose mission is to build unity across racial and economic lines and to organize, employ, and defend our most vulnerable populations. I hope I got that right, Estela.
Yes, you did. You did.
I visited El Centro for the first time a few years ago when I worked for the zoo, and we were interested in partnering. And the visit was a little life-changing for me. So we're going to hear more about the amazing work that El Centro does, about Estela and about the building and much more. So welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here, and thank you so much for wanting to share information about the work of El Centro de la Raza.
So let's start there. Tell us about El Centro. I loved visiting it so much, and I just wish every person could come there.
Well, I think, as you know, Lori, we have an amazingly rich history. And you mentioned 50 years. So next year, El Centro de la Raza will be 50 years old, started with a peaceful occupation of an old abandoned school building. And the significance of this occupation is that it was supported by communities of color, the anti-war movement at the time, the faith community. And people were supporting so that Chicano, Mexicano, Latinos could have a place to build a community. And so over those almost, 50 years, we've created many programs in the areas of children and youth, human and emergency services, educational and skill building programs, housing and economic development, and obviously a lot of cultural and advocacy work throughout that time. Now, I do want to share that, let's see, I think it was about a year and a half ago that El Centro de la Raza was put on the list of historic places on the National Register in this country. And so we are considered a historic place, and that is quite significant. And it's not so much because of the age of the building, because the old Beacon Hill School building is about 100 and close to 120 years old. But it was the history that happened there when people of all races came together, unified, and won a building for the Chicano Latino community, and then all that has happened in those almost 50 years. Last year, also, there was a textbook published about the history of El Centro de la Raza. And I say textbook because it is being marketed to universities and colleges around the country. So that was in January of 2020. And then in September of 2020, the book came out in paperback. So it's both in paperback and what is it? Hardbound. So very excited about that. We haven't been able to really do the work of promoting the book because of COVID. And as things begin to settle down, hopefully by the end of the year, we'll pick up on that work. And we didn't even, the governor was supposed to do like something special to make this announcement of being a historic place. But busyness and then COVID struck and didn't happen.
Wow. So when I visited, there was a very beautiful statue in the plaza. Tell us about the statue and about the man that the statue is named for.
Well, when Roberto passed away in September of 2010, our board of directors wanted to do something significant for him. And they even thought about like, well, let's rename the El Centro de la Raza building. And I said, wait a minute. I know that Roberto would not want that, that we would change the name of El Centro de la Raza. And, for the audience, it translates in the Center for for people of all races. And throughout these almost 50 years, we have basically just always honored and thought about how do we integrate whatever we're doing for the Latino community, how do we integrate that others will feel welcomed at El Centro de la Raza, and that's from, you know, the services that we provide and the cultural events like Dia de los Muertos that has become very open to all people. But in going back to the statue, you know, we put a call out for artists on how they might incorporate multicultural art. When you put it out, there was also information about El Centro de la Raza. So one artist, and the artist was from Spain, that bid on the project and showed all of the work that he had done throughout Europe and Spain and was beginning to do some work in the US. And he proposed that there be a statue done of Roberto. And he had done some magnificent work that was very lifelike. And that's kind of how, you know, that evolved. And we knew that we couldn't use public money, you know, for something like that. So we raised private funds and through a little bit of money from our developer's fee, you know, that we earn when you do a project like that. So that's how it came about. And it's, you know, it's been interesting over the years how people love to take pictures. They put a mask on him. They put a bandana on him. Children, you know, come up and kind of just stare at him. And it's been beautiful. And it is, you know, our community, our children need to remember who our heroes are, who are people who make significant contributions. And so I think it's a great thing that we did. And the other thing too, that we talked a lot about as we were raising funds for the statue, is that statues have been reserved mostly for white men. And it was time to turn that around. And so, you know, having this, even though I know that there's a statue for Jimi Hendrix on Capitol Hill, and Chief Seattle, I think, is in Bollinger Park or some other place like that. But it's changing the tide that we also can have statues of people of color so that they are remembered for a lifetime.
You know, Seattle, this sudden change we've had over the last 10 years in Seattle, all the new people, the tech boom. Sometimes I'm afraid of losing the sense of history that we have. And some people might not even remember the Gang of Four.
Yes, I remember exactly.
For those who are new, what do we want people to know about the Gang of Four? This is Bernie White Bear, Bob Santos, Larry Gossett, and your husband. Do we want people to know about those four people and the differences they made?
You know, when you think about the times of when they came together, I think the lesson out of all of that is that when we unite as a people, especially people of all races, including our white allies, we can make significant change. And that was the lesson that came out of that. For Seattle, for King County, and that legacy of people working together, supporting each other, still lives on in Seattle, and I believe has only become stronger. You know, there's all types of, you know, coalitions that are made up, that are multiracial, that are in the health field, the education, you know, all the police accountability work. Just significant changes. And I would say that that is the primary and the most important lesson in their legacy.
And for those who do not know of those four remarkable people, it's worth learning. Go and read our history and look about what happened at, what was it, Fort Lawton. There are so many stories.
And, you know, in that book that I was referring to, it is on Amazon. So if people want to go and get it.
That's great. Yeah, I actually, I was, one of my clients was the YMCA of Seattle. This is maybe 10 or 11 years ago. And I actually wrote the press release when the AK Guy
Award
was given to the Gang of Four. And I remember going to the room as they all were preparing. And it was just like watching a wonderful reunion of four dear friends taking photos over in the corner. And I had never heard of the Gang of Four. And I grew up here. And I remember that's when I first started thinking something's wrong with my education system.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because I do want to share something that I think mm-hmm. is important too, is that these men came together. You know, they were very serious about the work in terms of building unity and making change for the benefit of our communities. But they also had a lot of fun. You know, they they enjoyed each other. They joked around. And I think, you know, when you're in the midst of hard struggle, humor is so important to lighten it up. And, you know, and that still goes on. But I think that they're the ones that sort of coined that, you know, where they would laugh about, even when things were difficult, you start laughing. Hey, you know, all you can do is laugh about it, you know, at some point.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that sense of humor and love that was felt. You know, the last year has just been so difficult, and it's very easy in my own bubble to talk about difficulties because I miss my friends. I miss theater. I have kids in college who are sad about not being able to see friends in college. And I find myself constantly reminding people that the difficulty that they feel is often less difficulty than many other people feel. And that there are people and communities who have faced difficulty for a long, long time. What have you found in terms of the impacts of COVID during this period on the community that you work with most frequently?
You know, I think that many people have said, and it's definitely true, is that COVID has made more apparent, you know, the disparities in community, you know, whether it's what's happening, you know, with the homeless, those who are hungry. I mean, Latinos are 31% have food insecurity. And we are a people that work. You know, we will find jobs wherever and try to work to support our families. And the fact that I know that we're working people, we are essential workers, you know, the childcare centers that are working have lots of Latino people, the Instacart people who are delivering are Latinos there also. And to know that in King County, the 31% face food insecurity is pretty amazing. And so those disparities have been, you know, made apparent not only in the Latino community, but in all communities of color and in low income, you know, working class families also. And the disparities are there and we've got to figure out how we deal with them on the long term. But I also feel like Seattle, King County, the state of Washington, has been as generous and helpful as they possibly can. And, you know, from all the dollars that were allocated for, you know, undocumented and the children and spouses of the undocumented who were left out of the stimulus bill, you know, I feel like our state and helped on that and our city governments, they did a lot, but clearly it's not enough. You know, it's not enough and more has to be done. But, you know, we have seen so many people who need, you know, rent assistance, you know, the implications of that where we have to talk to, call landlords and remind them that they cannot be evicting people and that we're going to be helping with a certain portion of rent to help people with, again, people who are food insecure, people, you know, families who need diapers for their babies. When, you know, people started calling and asking us for gas money, I thought, oh my God, you know, this is it's being really hard on people. So again, I felt like Washington State responded incredibly, but there's just so much more still to do, you know. And then the difficulty of, you know, the whole technological question around education and, you know, children, you know, having to figure out with their families on how to function, go to school with Zoom, you know, all that that represents, you know, for some people. I mean, I have a couple of my grandchildren go to Federal Way, and they're in elementary school. And, you know, my daughter would tell me is that there were parents on these parent meetings saying, you know, like, they gave us a computer, but I don't even know what to do with it. And so there's just a lot of work that needs to get done in that arena. So,
yeah, it's, you know, since the murder of George Floyd, everyone for the last year has belatedly, and when I say everyone, I talk about many of my white friends, belatedly are all very focused on institutional racism. And that's wonderful, because we're all now waking up and starting to talk about our own lives and how we contribute and where are those areas. And it's like every time you identify another area where, okay, we have systemic racism in our healthcare system, then you turn, oh, it's in housing, inherited wealth. I mean, the list goes on and on. And one of the areas where we definitely know we see that is in education.
Yes.
Tell me about your experience in terms of looking at kids and looking at the educational experience that kids have. I mean, it varies so wildly from school to school, from zip code to zip code. Has it always been like that in Seattle? That's not a new development, right?
Well, you know, I think that there's always been issues of institutional racism. Now, I can tell you from the Latino perspective is that, you know, our kids are graduating at, you know, somewhere at like at a 64% rate. They're dropping at, you know, somewhere hovering around 23%. You know, the poverty rate is, I think, 20% or even more than that. What I have noticed, and I'm not sure, and this is something that we have been talking about for 3 or 4 years also, is that there seems to be, even though Latino kids are having a hard time, those disparities are not being talked about. That data is not being given out. And, you know, our position is that if you don't highlight data, and you can't create policy, and you can't create programs. And so we first started noticing this in the school district, and we also notice it in city government, where that data is just not coming out on the disparities. And like I said, COVID has brought it up. I was just looking at earlier a report that was done by the Seattle Foundation that came out in June of 2020. And that's a report that should be looked at in terms of the disparities that exist for Latino communities and all communities. Because when I talk about that data is not being released so that people know it and that those who want to help or that we create policy, that I don't want that to be at the expense of other populations also at the same time. Because, you know, obviously we have a serious problem in communities of color, and all of the communities that are having those disparities need to grow together, and the problems need to be addressed simultaneously and not one at the expense of the other. So we're, you know, very, it's a topic. We were meeting with a school board member just a few days ago and raising, you know, that issue. Why is the district not making public the disparities that exist in Latino communities? And we are talking at the city level, data is not being disaggregated to also know what the issues are. And I just feel like I need to start talking about it more and talking to people about it so that, I mean, if you don't see the data, and what's happening in the Latino community, and you know that there's issues, we become invisible. And what I say is out of sight, out of mind.
What can allies do if they want to support El Centro, if they want to support the community? What's the best thing that they can do? Is it you know, as simple as supporting El Centro and coming and buying the book about El Centro or visiting El Centro? What can they do I'd love to just encourage everyone to visit because it's such a wonderful place. But what?
Yes, before COVID, obviously El Centro utilized, I don't know, I think it's somewhere in the vicinity of any, it could hover around, 20 to 23,000 hours of volunteer time and anywhere from 800 to 1,000 volunteers. And so volunteers have always been the lifeblood of El Centro. I mean, we started out as volunteers and the first 7 years of our existence, we all worked as volunteers. And so when we get back to normal, and I think that there's even ways to volunteer, remotely, but that I would encourage people to look at ways to volunteer with us. We place a significant importance on building people-to-people ties and getting to know each other. And so I look forward when we can open our doors again. But so through volunteering, we've got a lot of different programs that people can still remotely help on. We're actually creating a program for those parents who don't have a command of the technology that is going to be funded by Comcast to teach basically, a class and then work with people one-on-one. So we do need volunteers in that arena. Obviously contributing funds, to our emergency relief fund that Seattle and the region has been extremely generous to us and being able to help people. So those are a few things. And I think, in the final is standing up in their respective communities. We need our white allies talking to, with the white community about institutional racism. And raising the consciousness, because we may have won back our democracy. We may have won back the White House in terms of having a democratic government, but those forces have not gone away and are still organizing. And we have got to do everything that we can to create consciousness, to continue to register people to vote and have people involved in community. Because that's what eventually is going to win out this, ever how long it takes us.
One last question. What makes you feel encouraged right now? This is a tough time. Is it your grandchildren? What gives you joy now?
What I feel encouraged about is that we have great staff, that are working very hard. I am encouraged by everybody that has donated funds, who have donated, some people have bought computers and diapers and this and that. I'm encouraged that, that we as a people are helping each other. And on a personal note, yes, I'm encouraged by my grandchildren. I am very fortunate to live right next door to them. And I get to see them daily. We operate as one household. And just, for me and my family, it has brought us closer together in terms of doing things together, eating dinner, celebrating birthdays and graduations, and that you can do that as a family and feel that celebration. And it may not include your friends and other families, but you can celebrate really well together.
So there's, I frequently quote my favorite movie. It's A Wonderful Life. And there are a variety of wonderful quotes in there, but watching what you've done in the community reminds me of this one quote where they, in the movie, they say, "Strange, isn't it, the difference that one person's life can make. If they're not around, it leaves an awful hole." And I think about everything that you've done in the community over the years, and just want to say, as a big supporter of UNL Centro, you have done a lot for this community. So I wanted to say thank you. And you've really changed the fabric of our community.
Well, I appreciate that kindness, Lori. But what I feel is that the only reason that I've been able to do this work is that there is a collective of people at El Centro and a collective of people in our community that is working hard to, you know, have more justice for our communities, to have more equity and equality, and that we only can do it together. But I appreciate your kindness in that.
Well, it's great talking to you. And if people want more information on El Centro, where should they go?
They should go to our website, which is just very simple, elcentrodelaraza.org.
All right. Well, thank you. It's been so great talking to you again. Thank you for everything.
Yes. And thank you so much for the honor. And again, to all those who will be listening or watching, is that when COVID is over, know that El Centro de la Raza welcomes you and that you have a home there also. Thank you.
All right. Thanks again. It was great talking to you. And everyone else, I will come back to you another time soon with another Washington Game Changers. And if you want any information on the League of Education Voters, you can go to educationvoters.org. Thank you.